Where did I go wrong? Thought Vimes as the litany went on. I was a copper once. A real copper. I chased people. I was a hunter. It was what I did best. I knew where I was anywhere in the city by the feel of the street under my boots. And now look at me. A duke. Commander of the watch. A political animal. I have to know about who's fighting who 1,000 miles away, just in case that's going to mean riots here. When did I last go on patrol? Last week? Last month? And it's never a proper point patrol, because the sergeants make damn sure everyone knows I've left the building, and every damn constable reeks of armour polish and has had a shave by the time I get there, even if I nip down the back streets. And that thought, at least, was freighted with a little pride, because it showed he didn't employ stupid sergeants. I never stand all night in the rain, or fight for my life rolling in the gutter with some thug. I never move above a walk. That's all been taken away. And for what? Comfort. Power, money, and a wonderful wife. Which was a good thing, of course, but even so. Damn. But I'm not a copper anymore. I'm a manager. I have to talk to the damn committee as if they're children. I go to receptions and wear damn stupid toy armour. It's all politics and paperwork. It's all got too big. What had happened to the days when it was all so simple? Faded like the lilac, he thought. They entered the palace and went up the main stairs to the oblong office. The patrician of Ankh-Morpork was standing looking out of the window when they entered. The room was otherwise deserted. "Ah, Vimes," he said, without turning round. "I thought you might be late. In the circumstances, I dismissed the committee. They were sorry, as indeed I was, to hear about Strong in the Arm. No doubt you have been writing the official letter?" Vimes flashed a questioning expression at Carrot, who rolled his eyes and shrugged. Vetinari found out things very quickly.
"Yeah, that's right," said Vimes.
"And on such a beautiful day as this, too," said Vetinari. "Although there's a storm heading our way, I see." He turned. He had a sprig of lilac pinned to his robe. "Lady Sybil is doing well," he said, sitting down.
"You tell me," said Vimes.
"Some things can't be hurried, no doubt," said Vetinari smoothly, shuffling the papers. "Let me see now, let me see. There were just a few points that I should deal with. Ah, the regular letter from our religious friends at the Temple of Small Gods." He carefully removed it from the pile and set it to one side. "I think I shall invite the new deacon to tea and explain matters to him. Now, where was I? Ah, the political situation in... yes?" The door opened. Drumknot, the chief clerk, came in.
"A message for His Grace," he said, although he handed it to Lord Vetinari.
The patrician passed it very politely across the desk. Vimes unfolded it.
"It's off the clacks," he yelled. "We've got Carsa cornered in New Hall. I've got to get down there now."
"How exciting," said Lord Vetinari, standing up suddenly. "The call to the chase. But is it necessary for you to attend personally, Your Grace?" Vimes gave him a grey look.
"Yes," he said, "because if I don't, you see, some poor sod who's been trained by me to do the right thing is going to try to arrest the bugger." He turned to Carrot. "Captain, get on it right now. Clacks, pigeons, runners, whatever, I want everyone answering this shout, okay? But no one, I repeat, no one is to try to tackle him without a lot of backup, understood? And get Swires airborne." "Oh, damn."
"What's wrong, sir?"
"This message is from Littlebottom. She sent it straight here. What's she doing there? She's forensic. She's not street. She'll do it by the book."
"Shouldn't she?" said Vetinari.
"No. Carser needs an arrow in his leg just to get his attention. You shoot first and ask questions later," said Vetinari.
Vimes paused at the door and said, "There's nothing I want to ask him." Vimes had to slow down for breath in Satyr Square, and that was disgusting. A few years ago, he'd only really be getting into his stride by now. But the storm rolling over the plains was driving the heat before it, and it wouldn't do for the commander to turn up wheezing. As it was, even after pausing behind a street market stall for a few gulps of air, he doubted if he had enough wind left for a lengthy sentence. To his tremendous relief, an entirely unwounded Corporal Chewy Littlebottom was waiting by the university walls. She saluted.
"Reporting, sir," she said.
"Murmured Vimes.
"'I spotted a couple of trolls on traffic duty, sir,' said Cheery. "'So I've sent them around to Waterbridge. "'Then Sergeant Detritus turned up, and I advised him "'to go into the university by the main gate and get up high. "'Sergeant Colon and Nobby arrived, and I sent them along to the Bridge of Sighs.'
"'Why?' said Vimes.
"'Because I doubt if he's really going to try going that way,' said Cheery, "'her face a very careful picture.'
Vimes had to stop himself from nodding.
"'And then, as more people came along, I'm putting them around the perimeter. "'But I think he's gone up and he's staying high.'
"'Why?'
"'Because how's he going to fight his way out through a lot of wizards, sir? "'His best chance is to sneak around the roofs and drop down somewhere quiet. "'There's lots of hiding places, and he can get all the way to Peach Pie Street without coming down.'
"'Forensic,' thought Vimes.
"'And with any luck, he doesn't know about Buggy.' "'Well thought out,' he said. "'Thank you, sir.' "'Would you mind standing a bit closer to this wall, sir?'
"'What for?' Something shattered on the cobbles. Vimes was suddenly flat against the wall.
"'He's got a crossbow, sir,' said Cheery. "'We think he stole it from Strong in the Arm, but he's not very good with it.'
"'Well done, Corporal,' said Vimes weakly. "'Good job.' He glanced around the square behind him. The wind was whipping at the awnings of the market stalls, and the traders, with occasional looks at the sky, were covering their wares.
"'But we can't just let him hang around up there,' he went on. "'He'll start taking pot shots, and he's bound to hit someone.' "'Why would he do that, sir?'
"'Carter doesn't need a reason,' said Vimes. "'He just needs an excuse.' A movement far above caught his eye, and he grinned. A large bird was gaining height over the city. The heron, mumbling complaints, fought for altitude in big, sweeping circles. The city whirled around Corporal Buggy Swires as he gripped even harder with his knees, and he swung the bird downwind, and it landed with a staggering run on top of the Tower of Art, the highest building in the city. With a practiced movement, the gnome sliced through the string holding the portable semaphore in place, and leapt down after it onto the compost of ivy leaves and old raven's nests that carpeted the top of the tower. The heron watched him with round-eyed stupidity. Buggy had tamed it in the usual gnome way. You painted yourself green like a frog, and hung out in the marshes, croaking, and then when a heron tried to eat you, you ran up the beak and nutted it. By the time it came around, you'd blown the special oil up its nostrils. That had taken all day to make, and the stink of it had emptied the watch house. And it took one look at you and thought you were its mum. A heron was useful. It could carry equipment. But Buggy preferred a sparrowhawk for traffic patrol. It was better for hovering. He slotted the portable semaphore arms onto the post he'd secretly installed weeks ago. Then he unshipped a tiny telescope from the heron's saddlebags and strapped it onto the edge of the stone, looking almost straight down. Buggy liked moments like this. It was the only time that everyone else was smaller than him. "'Now let's see what we can see,' he muttered. There were the university buildings, there was the clock tower of old Tom, and the unmistakable bulk of Sergeant Detritus climbing amongst the nearby chimneys. The yellow light of the gathering storm glinted off the helmets of watchmen who were hurrying through the streets. And there, creeping along behind the parapet, "Gotcha," he said quietly, and reached for the handles of the semaphore.
DTRTS space, HDNG space, OL space TM, said Cheery.
Vimes nodded. Detritus was on the roof near the Tower of Old Tom. And Detritus carried a siege crossbow that three men couldn't lift, and had converted it to fire a thick sheaf of arrows all at once. Mostly they shattered in the air because of the forces involved, and the target was hit by an expanding cloud of burning splinters. Vimes had banned him from using it on people. But it was a darn good way of getting into buildings. It could open the front door and the back door at the same time.
"Tell him to fire a warning shot," he said. "If he hits Carter with that thing, we won't even find a corpse."
"Though I'd quite like to find a corpse," he added to himself.
"Yes, sir."
Cheery pulled a couple of white-painted paddles out of her belt, sighted on the top of the tower, and sent a brief signal. There was an answering signal from the distant buggy.
"DTRTS space, WRNG space, SHD," Cheery muttered to herself as she waved the rest of the message.
There was another answering dip from above. A moment later, a red flare shot up from the top of the tower and exploded. It was an efficient way of getting everyone to pay attention. Then Vimes saw the message relayed. Around the university buildings, watchmen who'd also seen the order ducked into doorways. They knew about the bow. There were a few seconds for the troll to work out the spelling, a distant heavy thud, a sound like a swarm of hellish bees, and then a crash of tiles and masonry. Pieces of tile rained down into the square. An entire chimney, still with a wisp of smoke coming from it, smashed down a few yards from where Vimes was standing. Then there was the patter of dust and small bits of wood, and a gentle shower of pigeon feathers. Vimes shook some flakes of mortar off his helmet.
"Yes, well, I think he's been warned," he said.
Half a weathercock landed next to the chimney. Cheery blew some feathers off a telescope and sighted on the top of the tower again.
"Boogie says he's stopped moving, sir," she reported. "Really, you surprise me."
Vimes adjusted his belt.
"And now you can give me a crossbow. I'm going up." "Sir, you said no one was to try to arrest him. That's why I sent the signal to you."
"That's right. I'm going to arrest him. Right now. While he's counting all his bits to check he's still got 'em. Tell Detritus what I'm doing, because I don't want to end up with 160 pounds of cocktail delicacies."
"No, don't keep opening your mouth like that. By the time we've sorted out backup and armour and got everyone lined up, he'll have dug in somewhere else."
The last words were delivered at a run. Vimes reached the door and darted inside. New Hall was student accommodation, but it was still only 10:30, so most of them would be in bed. A few faces looked around doors, and Vimes trotted along the corridor and reached the stairwell at the far end. That took him, walking now and rather less sure of his future, to the top floor. Let's see, he'd been here before. Yes, there was a door ajar, and a glimpse of mops and buckets suggested that this was a janitor's cupboard, with, at the far end, a ladder leading up to the roof. Vimes carefully cocked the crossbow. So, Carter had a watch crossbow too. They were good classic single-shot models, but they took a while to reload. If he fired at Vimes and missed, then that was the only shot he'd get. After that, you couldn't plan. Vimes climbed the ladder and the song came back. "They rise feet up, " he hissed under his breath. He stopped just below the edge of the open trapdoor onto the leads. Carter wouldn't fall for the old helmet-on-stick trick. Not with just one shot available. He'd just have to risk it. Vimes thrust his head up, turned it quickly, ducked out of sight for a moment, and then came through the opening in a rush. He rolled clumsily when he hit the leads and rose into a crouch. There was no one else there. He was still alive. He breathed out. A sloping, gabled roof rose up beside him. Vimes crept along, wedged himself against a chimney stack peppered with splinters of wood, and glanced up at the tower. The sky above it was livid blue-black. Storms picked up a lot of personality as they rolled across the plains, and this one looked like a record-breaker. But brilliant sunlight picked out the Tower of Art, and at the top, the tiny dots of Buggy's frantic signal. Oh. 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 Officer in trouble. A brother is hurting. Vimes spun round. There was no one creeping up on him. He eased himself around the chimneys, and there, tucked between another couple of stacks and out of sight of everyone except Vimes and the celestial Buggy, was Carsa. He was taking aim. Vimes turned his head to spot the target. 50 yards away, Carrot was picking his way across the top of the university's high-energy magic building. The bloody fool was never any good at concealment, though he ducked and crept, and against all logic that made him look more noticeable. He didn't understand the art of thinking himself invisible. And there he was, furtively schlepping through the debris on the roof and looking as visible as a big duck in a small bathtub. And he'd come up without backup. The fool. Carsa was aiming carefully. The roof of the HEM was a maze of abandoned equipment, and Carrot was moving along behind the raised platform that held the huge bronze spheres known throughout the city as the Wizard's Balls, which discharged surplus magic if, or more usually when, experiments in the hall below fouled up. Carrot, screened by all that, was not making a good target. Vimes raised his crossbow. Thunder rolled. It was the roll of a giant iron cube down the stairways of the gods, a crackling, thudding crash that tore the sky in half and shook the building. Carsa glanced up and saw Vimes.
What you doing, mister?
Buggy didn't budge from the telescope. A crowbar wouldn't have separated them at this point.
Shut up, you daft cobbies,
he muttered. Both men below had fired, and both men had missed because they were trying to fire and dodge at the same time. Something hard prodded Buggy's shoulder.
What's happening, mister?
Said the insistent voice. He turned. There were a dozen bedraggled ravens behind him, looking like old men in ill-fitting black cloaks. They were the Tower of Art birds. Hundreds of generations of living in a highly charged magical environment had raised the intelligence level of what had been bright creatures to begin with. But although the ravens were intelligent, these weren't hugely clever. They just had a more persistent kind of stupidity, as befitted birds for whom the exciting panorama of the city below was a kind of daytime TV.
"Push off!"
shouted Buggy, and turned back to the telescope. There was Kalsa running, and Vimes running after him, and here came the hail. It turned the world white. It thudded around him and made his helmet ring. Hailstones as big as his head bounced on the stone and hit Buggy from underneath, cursing and shielding his face with his arms, and hammered all the time by shattering crystal balls, each one predicting a future of pain. He skidded and slid across the rolling ice. He reached an ivy-hung arch between two lesser turrets, where the heron had already taken refuge, and fell inside. Frozen shrapnel still ricocheted in and stung him, but at least he could see and breathe. A beak prodded him sharply in the back.
"What's happening now, mister?"
Carcer landed heavily on the arch between the student hall and the main buildings, almost lost his footing on the tiles, and hesitated. An arrow from a watchman below grazed his leg. Vimes dropped down behind him just as the hail hit. Cursing and slipping, one man followed the other across the arch. Carcer reached a mass of ivy that led up onto the roof of the library and scrambled up it, scattering ice below. Vimes grabbed the ivy just as Carcer disappeared onto the flat roof. He looked around at a crash behind him and saw Carrot trying to make his way along the wall from the high-energy magic building. The hail was forming a halo of ice fragments around him.
"Stay there!" Vimes bellowed.
Carrot's reply was lost in the noise. Vimes waved his arms and then grabbed at the ivy as a foot slipped.
"Bloody stay there!" he yelled. "That is an order! You'll go over!"
He turned and started up the wet, cold vines. The wind dropped, and the last few hailstones bounced off the roof. Vimes stopped a few feet from the top of the ivy, worked his feet into firm footholds in the ancient knotted stems, and reached up for a decent hold. Then he thrust himself up, left hand ready, caught the boot that swung towards him, and carried on rising, pushing Carcer off balance. The man sprawled backwards on the slippery hail, tried to get onto his feet, and slipped again. Vimes tugged himself onto the roof, stepped forward, and found his legs skidding away beneath him. Both he and Carcer got up, tried to move, and fell over again. From a prone position, the man landed a kick on Vimes's shoulder, sending both of them sliding away in opposite directions, and then turned over and scuttled on all fours around the library's big glass and metal dome. He grabbed the rusty frame, hauled himself upright, and pulled out a knife.
"Come and get me, then,"
he said. There was another roll of thunder.
"I don't have to," said Vimes. "I just have to wait."
"At least until I get my breath back," he thought.
"Why are you picking on me? What am I supposed to have done?"
"Couple of murders ring a bell," said Vimes.
If injured innocence was money, Carcer's face was his fortune.
"I don't know anything about—"
"I'm not up here to play games, Carcer. Knock it off."
"Are you going to take me alive, Your Grace?"
"You know, I don't want to. But people think it's neater all round if I do."
There was a clattering of tiles away on the left, and a thud as a huge siege bow was rested on the ridge of a nearby roof. The head of Detritus arose behind it.
"Sorry about that, Mr. Vimes. Hard to climb up in dat hail. Just stand back."
"You're going to let it shoot me?"
said Carcer. He tossed the knife away.
"An unarmed man?"
"Trying to escape," said Vimes.
But this was starting to go bad. He could feel it.
"Me? Well, I'm just standing here. Ha, ha."
And there it was, that bloody laugh on top of that damn grin. It was never far away. Ha-ha didn't come close to doing it the injustice it deserved. It was more a sort of a modulation to the voice, an irritatingly patronizing chortle that suggested that all this was somehow funny and you hadn't got the joke. Trouble was, you couldn't shoot someone for having an annoying laugh, and he was just standing there. If he ran,
you could shoot him. Admittedly, it would be detritus doing the shooting, and while with that bow it was technically possible to shoot to wound, the people you were wounding would probably be in the building next door. But Carsa was just waiting there, insulting the world by his existence. In fact, he wasn't merely standing there now. In one movement he'd swung himself onto the lower slopes of the library's dome. The glass panes, at least the glass panes that had survived the freak hail, creaked in the iron framework. "Stop right there," Vimes bellowed, "and come down." "Now, where could I go?" said Carsa, grinning at him. "I'm just waiting for you to arrest me, right? Hey, I can see your house from up here." "What's under the dome?" thought Vimes. "How high are the bookcases? There's other floors in the library, aren't there? Like galleries. But you can definitely look up at the dome from the ground floor, right? If you were careful, could you swing onto a gallery from the edge of the dome? It'd be risky, but if a man knew he was going to swing anyway..." Picking his way with care, he reached the edge of the dome. Carsa climbed up a little further. "I warn you, Carsa. Only I spirits, Mr. Grace. Can't blame a man for trying to enjoy his last few minutes of freedom, can you?" "I can see your house from up here." Vimes hauled himself onto the dome. Carsa cheered. "Well done, you Vimes," he said, easing himself towards the top. "Don't mess me about, Carsa. It'll go badly for you." "Badder than it's going to go anyway." Carsa glanced down through a smashed pane. "Long way down, Mr. Vimes. I reckon a man'd die instantly falling all that way, wouldn't he?" Vimes glanced down, and Carsa leapt. It didn't go the way he'd planned. Vimes had been tensed for something like this. After a complicated moment, Carsa was lying on the iron latticework, one arm under him, the other outflung and being banged heavily on the metal by Vimes. The knife it had held skidded away down the dome. "God, you must think I'm stupid," Vimes growled. "You wouldn't throw away a knife, Carsa, if you didn't have another one." Vimes's face was close to the man's now, close enough to look into the eyes above that chirpy grin and watch the demons waving. "You're hurting me, and that's not allowed." "Oh, I wouldn't want anything to happen to you, Carsa," said Vimes. "I want to see you in front of his lordship. I just want to hear you admit something for once. I just want to see that bloody cheeky grin wiped off your face. Sergeant Detritus?"
"Sir?"
shouted the troll from his distant ridge. "Make a signal. I want people up here now. Me and Carsa are just going to stay nice and quiet here so he doesn't try any tricks."
"Right, sir."
With another distant clatter of doomed tiles, the troll disappeared from view. "You shouldn't have sent Captain Carrot away," muttered Carsa. "He doesn't like watchmen bullying innocent civilians." "It is true that he has yet to master some of the finer details of de facto street policing," said Vimes, maintaining his grip. "Anyway, I'm not hurting you, I'm protecting you. Wouldn't like you to fall all that way." Thunder rumbled again. The sky wasn't just storm black now. There were pinks and purples in the clouds, as though the sky was bruised. Vimes could see the clouds moving like snakes in a sack, to an endless, sullen rumbling. He wondered if the wizards had been messing about with the weather. Something was happening to the air. It tasted of burned metal and flints. A weathercock on top of the dome began to spin round and round.
"I didn't think you were stupid, Mr. Vimes."
"What?" said Vimes, looking down suddenly. Carsa was smiling cheerfully.
"I said, I didn't think you were stupid, Mr. Vimes. I know a clever copper like you would think I'd got two knives."
"Yeah, right," said Vimes. He could feel his hair trying to stand on end. Little blue caterpillars of light were crackling over the ironwork of the dome, and even over his armour.
"Mr. Vimes?"
"What?" Vimes snapped. Smoke was rising from the weathercock's bearings.
"I got three knives, Mr. Vimes,"
said Carsa, bringing his arm up. The lightning struck. Windows blew out and iron gutters melted. Roofs lifted into the air and settled again. Buildings shook. But this storm had been blowing in from far across the plains, pushing the natural background magic ahead of it. It dumped it now all in one go. They said afterwards that the bolt of lightning hit a clockmaker's shop in the Street of Cunning Artificers, stopping all the clocks at that instant. But that was nothing. In Baker Street, a couple who'd never met before became electrically attracted to one another and were forced to get married after 2 days for the sake of public decency. In the Assassin's Guild, The chief armourer became hugely, and since he was in the armoury at the time, tragically attractive to metal. Eggs fried in their baskets, apples roasted on the greengrocer's shelves, candles lit themselves, cartwheels exploded. And the ornate tin bath of the Arts-Chancellor of Unseen University was lifted neatly off the floor, sizzled across his study, and then flew off the balcony and onto the lawn in the octangle several stories below, without spilling more than a cupful of suds. Arch-Chancellor Mustrom Ridcully paused with his long-handled scrubbing brush hovering halfway down his back and stared around. Tiles smashed to the ground around him. Water boiled in the ornamental fountain nearby. Ridcully ducked as a stuffed badger, the origin of which was never ascertained, flew across the lawn and smashed through a window. He winced as he was hit by a brief and inexplicable shower of small cogwheels, which pattered down all around him. He stared as half a dozen watchmen dashed into the octangle and headed up the steps to the library. Then, gripping the sides of the bath, the Arch-Chancellor stood up. Foaming water cascaded off him, as it would off some ancient leviathan erupting from the abyssal sea.
"Mr. Stevens," he bellowed, his voice bouncing off the imposing walls, "where the is my hat?"
He sat down again and waited. There was a few minutes of silence, and then Ponder Stevens, head of inadvisably applied magic and prelector of Unseen University, came running out of the main door carrying Ridcully's pointy hat. The Arch-Chancellor snatched at it and rammed it on his head.
"Very well," he said, standing up again. "Now we'll care to tell at the is going on, and why old Tom Ing repeatedly?"
Magic, sir. I went up the mechanism," Ponder shouted above the sound-destroying silences. Old Tom, the university's venerable clock, told not sounds but silences. Not simple, ordinary silences, but intervals of noise-absorbing non-sound that filled the world with loud soundlessness. There was the dying metallic noise from the big clock tower. Ponder and Ridcully waited a few moments, but the city stayed full of normal noise like the collapse of masonry and distant screams.
"Right," said Ridcully, as if grudgingly awarding the world a mark for trying. "What was all that about, Stevens? Why are there policemen in the library?"
The big magical storm, sir, in several thousand gigathorms. I believe that the watch is chasing a criminal."
"Well, they can't just run in here without asking," said Ridcully, stepping out of the bath and striding forward. "What do we pay our taxes for, after all?"
We don't actually pay taxes, sir," said Ponder, running after him. The system is that we promise to pay taxes if the city ever asks us to, but provided the city promises never to ask us, sir. We make a voluntary..."
"Well, at least we have an arrangement, Stevens."
Yes, sir. May I point out to you that you..."
"And that means they have to ask permission. The essential decencies must be maintained," said Ridcully firmly. "And I am the master of this college."
On the subject of decencies, sir, you are not, in fact, wearing..." Ridcully strode through the open doors of the library.
"What's going on here?" he demanded.
The watchman turned and stared. A large blob of foam, which up until that point had been performing sterling service in the cause of the essential decencies, slipped slowly to the floor.
"Well," he snapped, "haven't you lot seen a wizard before?"
A watchman snapped to attention and saluted.
"Captain Carrot, sir, we've never seen so much of a wizard, sir."
Ridcully gave him the slow, blank stare used by those with acute uptake-grasping deficiency.
"What's he talking about, Stevens?"
he said out of the corner of his mouth.
You're insufficiently dressed, sir."
"What? I've got my hat on, haven't I?"
"Yes, sir."
"Hat equals wizard. Wizard equals hat. Everything else is frippery. Anyway, I'm sure we're all men of the world,"
Ridcully added, looking around. For the first time, he took in the other details about the watchman.
"And dwarves of the world? Ah, trolls of the world, too, I see. And, women of the world, too, I note."
The Arch-Chancellor lapsed into a moment's silence and then said,
"Mr. Stevens?"
"Yes, sir?"
"Would you be so kind as to run up to my rooms and fetch my robe?"
"No, of course, sir."
"And in the meantime, please be so good as to lend me your hat."
"But, you do actually have your hat on, sir,"
said Ponder.
"Quite so, quite so," said Ridcully,
slowly and carefully through his fixed grin.
"And now, Mr. Stevens, in addition, right now,
I wish you, in fact, to lend to me your hat, please.
Oh, said Ponder. Oh, yes. A few minutes later, a thoroughly clean and decent and clothed Arch-Chancellor was standing in the very centre of the library, staring up at the damaged dome, while beside him, Ponder Stibbons, who for some reason had elected to continue to remain hatless, even though his hat had been handed back to him, stared glumly at some magical instruments.
"Nothing at all," said Ridcully.
"Ook," said the librarian, who was an orangutan, changed from his former human shape as a result of a long-forgotten magical accident. It was so forgotten, in fact, that now people were forgetting he was an orangutan. This might seem quite hard to do, given that even a small orangutan is quite capable of filling all immediately available space, but to the wizards and most of the citizens, he was now just the librarian. And that was that. In fact, if some ever reported that there was an orangutan in the library, the wizards would probably go and ask the librarian if he'd seen it.
"You've searched everywhere!"
"And he can't search everywhere in this library, sir," said Ponder. "That would take more time than actually could possibly exist. But all the mundane shelves, certainly,
Carrot turned to Ponder.
"What was he for, please, sir?"
You understand that this is a magical library, and that means that even in normal circumstances, there is an area of high magical potential above the bookshelves."
"I have been here before," said Carrot.
"Then you know that time with libraries is somewhat more flexible," said Ponder. "Given the additional power of the storm, it might just be possible that...
Are you going to tell me he's been moved in time?" said the watchman.
Ponder was impressed. He hadn't been brought up to believe that watchmen were clever. However, he took care not to show it.
"Would that it were that simple," he said. "However, the lightning appears to have added a random lateral component."
"A what?" said Ridcully.
"You mean in time and space," said Carrot.
Ponder felt himself getting rattled. Non-wizards shouldn't be that quick.
"Not exactly," he said, and gave up. "I'm really going to have to work on this, Arch-Chancellor. Some of the readings I'm getting can't possibly be real."
Vimes knew that he had woken up. There had been darkness and rain and a terrible pain in his face. Then there had been another flowering of pain on the back of his neck, and a feeling of being pulled this way and that. And now there was light. He could see it through his eyelids. His left eyelid, anyway. Nothing but pain was happening on the other side of his face. He kept the eyes shut and strained his hearing instead. Someone was moving about. There was a chink of metal. A woman's voice said, "He's awake."
"Are you sure?" said the man's voice. "How can you tell?"
"Because I'm good at telling if a man's asleep," said the woman. Vimes opened his eye. He was lying on a bench or table of some sort. A young woman was leaning against the wall next to him, and her dress and bearing and the way she leaned filed immediately in Vimes' policeman brain as seamstress, but one of the bright ones. The man had a long black robe and a silly floppy hat that got filed under, "Help, I'm in the hands of a doctor." He sat bolt upright.
"You lay one hand on me and I'll thump you," he yelled, trying to swing his legs off the table.
Half his head burst into flame.
"I should take it easy if I were you," said the doctor, gently pushing him back. "That was a very nasty cut, and don't touch the eye patch."
"Cut!"
said Vimes, his hand brushing the stiff cloth of an eye patch. Memories interlocked.
"Carter, did anyone get him?"
"Whoever attacked you got away," said the doctor.
"After that fall," said Vimes, "he must have been limping at least. Look, I've got to get—"
Then he noticed all the other things. He'd been picking him up all the time, but only now did the subconscious present the list. He wasn't wearing his own clothes.
"What's happened to my uniform?"
he said. And he noticed the "I told you so" expression the woman gave the doctor. "Whoever attacked you stripped you down to your drawers and left you lying in the street," she said. "I found you some spare clothes at my place. It's amazing what people leave behind."
"Who took my armour?"
"I never know names," said the woman. "I saw a bunch of men running off carrying stuff, though."
"Ordinary thieves, didn't they leave a receipt?"
"No," she said, laughing. "Why should they?"
"And are we allowed to ask questions?"
said the doctor, tidying his tools. None of this was right.
"Well, I mean, thank you, yes," said Vimes.
"What's your name?"
Vimes's hand stopped halfway to his face again.
"You mean you don't know me?"
he said.
"Should we?"
said the doctor. None of this was right.
"This is Hank Moorpork, isn't it?" said Vimes.
Yes, said the doctor, and turned to the woman. "There was a blow to the head," he said, "but I wouldn't have thought it was that bad."
"Look, I'm wasting time," said the woman. "Who are you, mister?"
Everyone in the city knew Vimes, surely. The Guild of Seamstresses certainly did, and the doctor didn't look stupid. Perhaps this was not the right time to be totally truthful. He might just be somewhere where being a copper wasn't a good thing to be. It might be dangerous to be Vimes, and right now he wasn't well enough to deal with it.
"Keel," he said.
The name just dropped into his mind. It had been bubbling just under the surface of his thoughts all day, ever since the lilac.
"Yeah, right," said the woman, smiling. "Want to make my first name?"
"John," said Vimes.
"Appropriate. Well, John, it's like this. Men lying flat out and naked round here aren't all that uncommon. And it's a funny thing, but they don't usually want anyone to know their real name or where they live. You won't be the first one Dr. Lawnear has patched up. My name's Rosie. And now there's a little fee, you understand, for both of us?"
"All right, all right, all right. I know how this goes," said Vimes, holding up his hands. "This is the Shades, right?"
They both nodded.
"Okay, then. Thank you. I haven't got any money, obviously, but once I've got home..."
"I'll escort you, shall I?" said the woman, handing him a badly styled coat and a pair of antique boots. "I wouldn't like you to be attacked by anything. A sudden loss of memory, for example."
Vimes snapped, but very gently. His face hurt, and there were plenty of other bruises everywhere, and he was dressed in a suit that smelled like a privy. He'd go up the watch house, get cleaned and changed, and make a quick report, and head on home. And this young lady could spend a night in the cells, and then be handed over to the Seamstresses Guild. They came down heavily on extortion like this. It was bad for trade.
"All right," he said,
and he pulled the boots on. The soles were made of cardboard, and they were too tight.